Hello, and welcome back to the Portsmouth Comic Con podcast. I am your host, Luke Bug, the Geek of Steel, and this event, the Portsmouth Comic Con, is just around the corner, the 11th and 12th of May. Whilst I've been hosting this podcast, it's made me even more excited for this weekend that is one of my most favourite ones of the year. And as you can tell, I'm excited. On this episode, I got to speak with two of the guests that will be at this year's event. The first was Michael Carter, an actor from Star Wars, The House of the Dragon, and American Werewolf in London. Michael was a charming guest. He shared some fantastic stories, and I'm sure he'll be sharing a lot more at this year's event. And the second guest was Hades from ASAP Imagination, a comic publisher. Hades was so passionate about comics, about events, about looking after not only comics as a medium, but looking after the people that create them. And I'm sure Hades will be very busy at this year's event because he understands how important comics are, not just in general, but Comic-Cons. The clue is in the title. I had a great time talking with these two guests, and I know they're going to be fantastic at this year's con on the 11th and 12th of May. And if you don't have your tickets yet, hurry up, and you can get yours at portsmouthcomiccon.com. So, without further ado, please enjoy this latest episode of the Portsmouth Comic Con podcast. It is time for another episode of the Portsmouth Comic Con podcast, and I'm joined today by Mr. Michael Carter, who will be coming along to Portsmouth Comic Con on the 11th and 12th of May. An actor, a writer, a legend from the world of movies and entertainment. So first of all, sir, thank you so much for coming on and having a chat today.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
I've got a few questions that I would like to ask you, but really just because as I've been researching this interview, I've just been falling more and more in love with your fantastic voice. It's a perfect voice, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of it. So if you could share a little bit of your very exciting and successful origin story, how did it all begin for you, sir?
Well, I was born in a small town in Scotland, southwest Scotland, and it really began. My father, who was a church organist, decided to do a school pantomime with Sunday school pantomime with the Sunday school kids. And we did Babes in the Wood. I was about 7 or 8, something like that. I mean, just a giggle. And because I was the producer's son, I got the funniest part in the in the pantomime. We just did it really for the parents. But it got a bit of press coverage and all that sort of stuff. I did 3 of those, and then my mother, each year, decided that I needed to stop and concentrate on getting a decent pass to go to senior school. And I forgot about acting, really, until late in my teens. I decided my last year at school to audition for a production of Much Ado About Nothing by Shakespeare. I thought I'd ideally get one of the comic parts in The Watch, and I ended up playing Benedick, who's the male lead. And then people started saying, you could be an actor. And I thought, the idea of being an actor was just a million miles away from anything in that part of Scotland. No way. John Laurie, Private Fraser from Dad's Army.
Yes.
He was at the same time as me, and he was at the same school. And I briefly got to know him later. But the local amateur theater asked me to join them. And one of the guys there, who was the local tax inspector, advised me to apply to drama school, and he coached me. And I wasn't really committed to it. I thought, well, I mean, he gave me a list of drama schools to apply to. There were only about half a dozen in the whole country. Now there are hundreds, And I applied. I thought, well, I'll do the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art first. That's the most difficult one to get into. And if I don't get into that, I'll forget about it. I'll forget about being an actor, and I'll just go off and do whatever. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. None at all. Anyway, I auditioned to RADA. I remember that. And I really wasn't nervous because I wasn't that keen on going. I hadn't kind of committed myself to wanting to be an actor. And lo and behold, a week later, I got a letter offering me a place. So that was it. So I went to drama school, and then I kind of did the usual stuff that you did in those days. You went into rep, and then gradually you got a bit of telly. There wasn't much of a film industry then. It really was almost non-existent. And just it gradually built up, and I ended up doing shows in the West End of the National Theatre, and of course doing Jedi and a few other things along the way. And to a degree, although I regard myself as semi-retired now, it's still going on. There's no pattern or logic to an acting career. It's just you're like a feather for each wind that blows. You just go with the breeze. And sometimes I've been lucky, sometimes I haven't.
Well, beautifully put, though. I like a feather in the breeze. That's fantastically put. But yes, you are coming down to Portsmouth Comic Con, and as I was doing my research, I've seen that you were in an episode of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes back in the day. Was that right?
Yeah, the very first one, with well, obviously with Jeremy and Gail Hunnicutt. I played Gail Hunnicutt's husband, and Wolf Kahler, the Prince of Bohemia. Wolf is he turns up at these comic cons now and again. Wolf was in one of the early Star Wars films, and he's a friend of mine, Wolf. I didn't know him from Star Wars, but I used to live in North London, quite near him, and I recently gave him a lift up to Blackburn to a gig up there. I think it was Blackburn, yeah, one of those championship football team towns. Yeah, he's still looking great, still moving around. Yeah, we did that. That was the first one of I don't know how many they did, huge number. But that was great fun. That really was, I really enjoyed that. Jeremy was great fun. They were all great fun. They weren't very sure how long it might run. And of course, it just went on forever.
It did, yeah. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, big part of the Portsmouth history because he did live here for a while. So that's a
That's funny. Yeah,
fun little
yeah.
aspect. Now you're coming down to the Comic Con as well. It's a nice bit of synchronicity as it all
Yeah,
joins
that's
together.
right. He had a practice here, didn't he?
He did, yes. It's
Yeah.
quite a bit of trade here as well. But that's a fun little bit of trivia for you there. But yes, as you said, Star Wars, one of those big things that many people do know you for, but you've had a wide range of a career, which is fantastic. And my introduction to you, sir, was at a very young age, and I was probably a bit too young, but it was An American Werewolf in London. I think I was about 10, and my dad was watching the film, and it was on television, and he let me stay up to watch it because he wanted me to see just the amazing effects, the sort of the makeup and everything that went into play in that iconic film. And it's still gives me a few nightmares, I must say, especially being in London at night when the underground is quite quiet. I can't help but think of your scene there, sir.
Yeah, well, that was quite a scene to shoot. It was we shot it actually in an underground which was located under Tottenham Court Road tube station. It was
Okay.
like a tube line under it, just exactly the same. We didn't know about these things, but they're used for transporting various stuff. Some of it highly secret, some of it's just the Royal Mail, I think, uses it. And so it was then kind of set up and decked out to look like the proper platform, and we filmed through the night. Started very late and finished literally as the first commuters were going to work. And that final shot where I'm lying on the escalator and the camera is steady cameras coming up the stairs and I'm trying to look terrified. There were commuters going down the down escalators on either side, kind of watching what was going on. I was saying, oh, they're making a film. But people in London were so cynical, they paid no, not a blind bit of notice to, But I'd been ill, oddly enough. There was a kind of flu going around, a kind of pre-COVID, one of those serious flus like the red flu or whatever, and people were catching it. And I got it between the interview and filming. And I really got very ill. And I went to see my doctor, and he said, well, you've got this flu going around, 2 weeks in bed. And I said, I'm working next week. I've got to work. He said, you can't work next week. I said, I've got to work. And he said, well, it's done for three of my patients already. The three of his patients had already died of it. And anyway, I turned up and I did that nice shoot, feeling terrible. I'd lost something like 10 pounds in 10 days. I was very thin. And they were using a Steadicam. It was early days of the Steadicam, one guy running with a camera on a harness. And the focus for the Steadicam was a remote focus, which the focus puller had. He's hidden away and he's pulling in. It's his own remote signal. Because we were like 300 feet underground, the remote signal wasn't working. So shots were out of focus. So we were having to do 27, 28 takes. I was nearly dead. The cameraman, the Steadicam, looked like he was going to have a heart attack. It was a really tough night's filming. But we got it done. We got it done in the end. And
You
John
did.
Landis was great. He just cheered us up the whole time, kept us going. He
Yeah,
was.
there's a lot of running in that scene. So you did very well. Now that I know that you've been quite unwell, that's even more impressive.
Yeah, up staircases, along corridors. Yeah. I was quite young and fit in those days, but I was ill, so I didn't. I was very pleased to finish work. The final wrap
You
was
did
a very
well.
happy one for me. Yeah, it cured me of the flu, though.
Well, there
You
we
know.
go. That's all you need to be cured of the flu is to be chased by a werewolf through an
Well, yeah. There was one thing when I first arrived. John said, "Come and see the werewolf." So I went to see the werewolf. Now, the werewolf was an actor lying on a plank on pram wheels. There. And then from here up was the werewolf's shoulders, head, and the front legs. And he'd moved, and he's been pushed and pulled by various people operating wires that operated the face. Because
Yes.
now it's probably done by CGI, but that was literally puppeteers doing it. And it was huge. The head was huge. You don't get an idea of just how big that head was in the film. And John said, "Go up, look at it. It's made of yak hair. It's really, really kind of very fine hair. Stroke it." And the thing is just looking up at me. And of course, it was a setup. I put my hand forward to stroke it, and the werewolf suddenly went, I jumped back. He did it to everyone.
It was a tremendous, I said it was puppetry, but it was done so well. I can remember being terrified of, because it was such a huge beast. I think in that scene when you're on the escalator, you
Yeah.
don't see it that much. You see a glimpse of it,
Just see the front half of it, yeah.
and that fear does really build up. So
I mean,
it's,
the actor really, they had two actors. They were doing shifts, and they got the movement off. They got the movement off. So yeah, it was terrific.
yeah,
It
because
was.
you had that scene, and then that iconic scene in the cinema where you're also with the rest of the undead. I love
Yeah,
that.
that's right. Yeah, that was done. It was freezing cold. And the blood would freeze. It was plastic-based blood. It would actually freeze on your face. It would actually go solid on your face. Take forever to get off. But and Griffin Dunne, I think, when he was operating a puppet, and I think David, somebody was standing on a pile of beer crates. There was a hole in the floor, and they were having to stand on a pile of beer crates for some reason. It might have been Griffin, or it might have been David. I don't know which. I don't know which. I know Griffin was certainly operating puppets himself. He learned how to operate it himself. So all his movements were Griffin's, and his voice is behind the wall behind us. Yeah, that was a hairy couple of days filming that.
But I can remember that scene as a child. It was again all the undead. But looking back now, it's as a grown up, as one who should be allowed to watch these films, it's a very humorous scene. That there's lots of dark comedy there, which it's something that has brought me into the world of horror and horror comedy, but I don't think we don't get films like that anymore these days, that's for sure.
No, I don't think you do. I don't think you do. I mean, John said when we started, he said, "Look, it's a comedy, but you've got to play it absolutely straight, absolutely for real." And he wanted me to be very heavy in that scene, a bit sort of pompous. And he wanted the young couple to be very light. So you had that contrast. And, yeah, it worked. It worked because everybody did take it seriously. Originally, they thought of casting me as the detective, the funny detective, the assistant who keeps dropping things and making a fool of himself. And then he changed that. He suddenly recast me as Gerald Bringsley. And that's what my agent said, at least. So I got the chance to nearly kill myself at Tottenham Court Tube Station and plastic blood in my face for about.
Well, it was all worth it just to hear you say carnivorous lunar activities.
Oh,
That
yeah,
was a
blind. Yeah.
fantastic line.
Those lines, yeah. That's like kind of where lunar activities, yeah.
Well, that's the perfect way that person to say that line as well. And then, yes, of course, we can't really not talk about Star Wars and the impact you've had on that massive world of entertainment. How did that happen, Saren? And how did that come into your life?
Well, it was very straightforward. I mean, I'd done a show in the West End, of London, a theatre show, and I was kind of it did me a lot of good, and I went out for a loads of stuff afterwards. I was doing a TV series at the time. I got called in to do an interview at Twickenham Film Studios for a science fiction film called Dark Harvest. My agent said there's no breakdown, so I have no idea what it's about. Apparently, it's a part of an alien. Usually, the agent gets a breakdown, so you know what the film's about, or your character's about. So you walk in for the interview with some knowledge. But with this, there was nothing, absolutely nothing. She said, I don't know why they're doing this. I don't know why they're doing this. Nowadays, they do it with almost everything. It's like working for the Secret Service when you get an interview for a film now. But I went down to Twickers and I saw Richard Marquand, and he, very pleasant, really pleasant man. And he said, this doesn't start filming for about 3 months. It'll start just after your TV thing finishes. And it's a science fiction film. And the part we're thinking about for you is part of an alien. And you will speak a bit of English and you'll speak a bit of a funny kind of language. And it should be quite a laugh. It should be good fun. Are you interested? Now, I've never been asked that in an interview. Are you interested? And I said, what do you mean? Because he looked at me, he said, well, do you want the job? Do you want it? It's yours if you want it. This had never happened. I think it doesn't happen in interviews. And wasn't actually very keen. It didn't sound too alluring or attractive. And I said, well, you know what? He said, well, there'll be a bit of pre-production work. You'll have to go up to studios, get fitted out for the costume, and have to wear a certain kind of makeup. And the more and more he talked about it, the less and less attractive it seemed. And I said, oh, I don't know. Be honest, I don't know. He said, oh, come on, come on. It's going to be 5 weeks' work. It'll be great fun. It'll be good fun. It's a big movie, and it'll be 5 weeks' work. And, you know, you'll be with some great people. So I said, okay. And then he said, okay, now you've accepted it. I'll tell you what it really is. It's the third Star Wars film. And it's going to be called Revenge of the Jedi. But you mustn't tell anyone that. You mustn't tell a soul. I said, I won't tell anyone. I went straight home and told the kids, of course. And
Got those dad points.
yeah, but I said, don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone to the kids. They told everyone. But he kind of vaguely told me what it was about. And the thing is that in those days, I mean, I hadn't seen the first Star Wars film because I've been working in the theater, you know, in rep. You rehearse during the day, you perform at night. On Sundays, you just lie around learning lines and take it easy. You might go and see a film, you might not. I'd missed it. If it runs for 3 weeks in the cinema, you don't see it, it's gone. And there's this. It doesn't turn up. There's no CDs. So I didn't really know. You know, I knew it was a very popular film. I'd heard people talking about it. I'd seen Empire because I'd worked with Anthony Daniels on stage and he had made us all go along to see it. And we'd all gone along and seen it. I thought it was a good film. You know, I enjoyed it. I thought it was very different to any kind of science fiction film I'd seen because the ones I'd seen had all been, you know, these 50s black and white things with the flying saucers that you could see the wires spinning them. I thought, wow, that's pretty good. And the creatures, I thought, wow, that's amazing. So I knew it was going to be quite, you know, this was going to be something special. And that really was it. But I just kind of went up and started building on the makeup. I didn't realize what I was letting myself in for in the end. I didn't know who, you know, Biff Fortuna was going to be or what.
I mean, it's some
Oh.
serious, even now, in sort of how things they can get things to be so light on set and they can make things out of all these special foams. Was that a heavy piece that you had to wear? Because it looked intimidating.
Well, the polyurethane skull, the bit that went up at the back, that was the heaviest bit. It wasn't that heavy. By the end of the day, it felt like it weighed about 20 pounds because you're stuck in it all day. And there were 13 different pieces glued on my face each morning. Now, they had to be made each night because the edges of the pieces would begin to crinkle and warp during the day as I sweated into them. So by the end of the day, the makeup was always a bit of a mess. I was always being re-glued during the day and, you know, kind of dusted up a bit. So Nick Dudman would just literally rip off the pieces and chuck them in the bin. And then the next morning, the pieces would come. And if they were made well and the edges were smooth, they weren't blown, he could get it on pretty quickly. But if the edges were wrinkled, you were there for hours, literally there for hours in the makeup chair, as he put it on. So it was a bit of a, yeah, it wasn't easy, but you know, it's like a mask performance. You just do it. And as I say, I was young then. I wouldn't do it now. I wouldn't think about it. But nowadays, all I'd wear a blue ski mask or a green ski, but that would be it. You know, with some points in it, electronic points that the camera would pick up, and it would all be CG'd on later.
Which I feel does it does lose a bit of that movie magic. It still looks very impressive, but to see your scenes especially, and to see all that makeup and your eyes. Now, were they contact lenses you had on? And
Yeah. They were contact lenses. The guy who made them had a practice down in Pimlico, and they didn't quite fit. I mean, they gave me an optician throughout the course of the 5 weeks I was on the film. He was the film optician. Yeah, he went by the wonderful name of Richard Glass.
Oh,
And
fantastic.
I said to him, I said to him once, I said, "Why did you become an optician, Richard?" And he said, "Well, with my name, what else could I be?" But he was great. But he told me they don't quite fit. He said, "He's made them in a hurry. They don't fit the contours of your eyeball." But he was great because he had all the stuff there and he knew how to look after me. He put the
Okay.
drops in my eyes and he'd take them out when he felt it was necessary, put them back in again. And there were haptics. They were the ones that go right over your eye, you know, under the eyelid. Couldn't really see out of them very well. I had tunnel vision. They drilled holes in the middle. I mean, I was bumping into things the whole time, walking into people. The first take, which is a low camera shot up at the roof of the long corridor when the droids come in and greeted by Bib, and suddenly Bib comes into shot and the red eyes glow. You know, he says, "Diwala wanga." First time I did that, I couldn't see the mark. So they nailed a wooden baton on the floor and said, "When your toes hit the baton, Mike, stop. We've got you." So, you know, cameras roll, one of the first shots of the film. And I walk on the baton and go, and fell right over out of the frame, tripped up over it. So it was a bit like that for 5 weeks. As I say, I would often be looking in the wrong direction and they would have to retake it and say, "You've got to look this way." But we got through it.
Good, I'm glad. Yes, the eyes are impressive. When I'm not doing any of this blog stuff, I work in an optician's, and
Aha.
I deal with contact lenses quite a lot. So I know how uncomfortable just a regular contact lens can be when not treated correctly. So to see your ones, oh, it's a different class of lens, that's for sure.
Yeah. I had abrasions of the cornea at the end of the run. But your eye's very tough. It gets over that quite easily. But I couldn't really focus properly for about a week after the end of the run, you know.
All for the love of the job, Mike. That's what that is. But yes, but I mean, that's the thing. You're in this iconic role. You've got this wonderful voice and this wonderful face, and then you're plastered with makeup. And I tend to lose you a bit in that role. But then as you progress over the years, you have become the face on the screen, and you are being recognized more, and you are being recognized for your work. And another fantastic show that is still gaining more and more fans around the world is House of the Dragon, and obviously
All right,
the
yeah.
Game of Thrones franchise. That is another big fantasy series to be a part of.
It is actually. I mean, I have to confess, I had never seen Game of Thrones, and I knew about it, but we didn't have the right channel or whatever. I knew David Warner, who was originally offered that role. You know, and he did it quite well, and he couldn't do it because he was ill. He died, unfortunately. But he said to a mutual mate of ours that it was the best offer he'd ever had. I mean, David Warner, I think, was a great actor. I mean, seriously great actor who probably just born maybe 20 years too late. Otherwise, he'd have been one of the great British stage actors in the era of Olivier and Ralph Richardson and people like that. But he said it's the best offer he ever had. He played a king. He got to sit down. He had no lines. And he was paid money. What is there not to like?
Yes.
So when they offered it to me, I thought, well, I've got to take it, you know, because initially my agent rang me up and said, I'm sorry, there's no lines, Mark. You know, it's just, I thought, ah, come on, I'll do it. I'll do it. I did as my own little homage to David and spent a lot of time going up to get the costume built on me. And then went out there for the day's filming. And it was just amazing. And the first time I'd been at Leavesden, the new studios up near Watford, Luton. I mean, just extraordinary. The scale of the thing was just extraordinary that day. It's wonderful.
Yes, it's one of those shows where it's everything's so grandiose, and there's wonderful costumes and
Oh,
wonderful sets. There's details and every little frame, as it were, and your very regal robes. And it was a fantastic setting. How was it when you finally saw yourself on set and in that costume? How did you feel?
well, it was great because you just felt like a king. You know, he was there. It was a bit like the first time I saw Bib in the mirror and they put everything on. They wouldn't let me look. They turned me away from the mirror so I couldn't see it. And then they led me to a full-length mirror so I could see myself. How you look, in a sense, determines how you perform. It's a bit like a mask exercise. And with Jairus, it was just there. It just was. That was it. It was King Jairus. So you get on with it. But everybody around was the same, you know, dressed up in these extraordinary costumes, the long white wigs. And then, of course, we go off for a coffee break, and everybody would be rabbing away about this and the next thing, and, you know, what are you up to? It'd be very, you know, very unregal with everybody. It's just being out of, and you go
Just talking, sitting
back
around,
home.
talk,
Well,
talk. Yeah.
then you suddenly become very imperious.
Yes,
You're back
it.
home.
Yeah, it would be hard to sort of not let the ego take over when you're walking around in robes such as that.
Oh, there's always somebody there to puncture the ego.
Yes, it. Bring it back down a few pegs or two. But yes, it's wonderful roles that you have done. As we said, we've mentioned the Sherlock. You were part of Doctor Who many a year ago as well.
It was a long, long time ago. I just left drama school. I mean, I think I had two lines. It's something like yes, sir, and no, sir. We shot down at Dover Castle. Had a big gun battle. It was great fun because in those days you were given guns. They just put blanks in them, the real guns with blanks. And then that all changed because of the trouble with the IRA, and they became decommissioned. So you're firing off these SLR automatics. John Pertwee was lovely, very funny, nice man to work with. It was good fun. We had a sing song. There was a guy there called Max Diamond, who was a stuntman who founded the English Jousting Society. Max was well known in the profession, white moustache type of chap, you know.
Oh, yes.
But on it was Max, a bit of a, you know, look a bit like a sort of upmarket second-hand car salesman, you know, cravat and the white moustache. Want to buy a
Fantastic.
roller? Want to buy a roller? But in addition to being the man who founded the England Jousting Society, trained horses, was a wonderful stuntman. I think he was ex-military. He was also a songwriter, and he had written a couple of songs that were hits. But Charlie Drake, the
Oh,
comedian,
wow.
you ever heard
Yes,
of Charlie
I
Drake?
have. Yes.
Custer's Last Stand, Max had written, and My Boomerang Won't Come Back.
Whack. Yes,
I
fantastic
remember as a
comedic
kid
songs.
being,
Yes.
Max had written those. So every night in the hotel, Max would get the old Joanna, and we'd have
Oh,
a sing song. It
fantastic.
was great. It was so funny. It, all these songs that people knew from the old musicals, you know, just great fun.
It's wonderful
So
how you
that was a lovely job for a young guy to have just out of drama school,
well,
you
it
know.
would be. And as you said, as you put it, as a feather breezing through, you've been a part of these all these fantastic different fandoms, whether it be Star Wars or Doctor Who or
I
Game of
suppose so,
Thrones
yeah.
and slasher horror films as well. It's a wonderful sort of a this part of Patter this tapestry that you're a part of. And as you said, wonderful John Pertwee. My he's I don't necessarily have a favorite Doctor, but I do have a favorite Wurzel Gummidge, and
Definitely, yeah.
that was a show that
Definitely.
I grew up on. And again, looking back at that, I was showing my young nieces the very first episode when we see Wurzel Gummidge come to life. It's traumatic. It's very horrific. But it was a show that I grew up with, and that particular John Pertwee and Wurzel Gummidge are big
Yeah,
parts of my life. So yes,
right. My kids used to watch it. I used to watch it with them. And it's rerun on one of those
it
channels now.
is.
I find myself watching it.
And it still makes me smile, whether it be the Scarecrow Hop or the Scarecrow Maker.
Man.
It was a fantastic series that it did run for quite a few years. But that's the thing, we take these jobs on, and you never quite know who you're going to meet. And you've met some wonderful people over the years, and you've worked with some fantastic actors as well as yourself. And do you have any favorites that you've managed to work with over the years?
Well, I worked with Dustin Hoffman on stage, and he was great fun. He was good fun, but he was also a very generous actor on stage, a very generous man, in actual fact. We worked over here in the West End, and then we went to New York for about 6 months, and he made sure everybody was welcome. And I met a lot of people through him. You know, every night you go on stage, you look out on. Into the audience, and there'd be Steven Spielberg, there'd be Al Pacino, there'd be Paul Newman, there'd be all these Hollywood greats, and they'd all be crowded into his dressing room afterwards. And he was a great fan. I worked with George C. Scott on something, George C. Scott. I remember seeing him in Patton, Lust for Glory in the early 70s, which he won the Oscar for. I remember going to see this with my girlfriend at the time and two other friends. We were driving in the middle of London in a mini. In those days, you could park in the middle of London, and we were late. And I said, "I'll get out. I'll get the tickets in the cinema. They were going to park up and join me later." So I went in the cinema, and everybody had gone in. The film was about to start, and I got four tickets. And I'm hanging about in the foyer. The cinema manager comes up to me and he said, "Aren't you going to go in, sir?" And I said, "Well, I'm waiting for my friends. I've got their tickets." He said, "You mustn't miss the beginning of this film. You mustn't miss it, because it's just a huge cinema screen in those days. There were all the multiplex. It's just the American flag, and then this tiny figure walks up, General Patton, and starts his speech. You know, and it's one of the most striking openings to any film I've ever seen." He said, "You've got to go in." He says, "I'll wait here. When your friends come, I'll bring them in." So he took me in. He made me stand at the back of the cinema, and then he went out, and the film was about to start when he brought the other three in, and we stood at the back, and the whole thing started, and just watched him going out there, and it was extraordinary. I saw the beginning of the film, and then he took us to our seats, and of course, decades later, I was able to tell George C. Scott that story, and he just creased up with laughter, you know.
That's,
So yeah, I'm lucky. I have worked with a few people, interesting people.
and that's it. I mean, that's you're clearly a person that loves their work, which is wonderful to see. And that's something that I adore listening to and finding out about the films that people have been a part of, which is why I think there's something so special about Comic Cons, is when we can go and hear these stories that we might not necessarily get in an interview talking about a contact lens, or talking about you going to the cinema. Those are the sort of personal stories that one might get from a Comic Con. So I'm
Yeah.
looking forward to you attending this year, and I'm hopefully being some part of some panels and interviews. Over the years, have you seen people turn up at conventions dressed as yourself? Is that something that you've seen?
I've seen a few. I mean, it's a bit of a tricky costume to get into.
Yeah.
But I have seen some people who've actually gone to the trouble to do it, both here and in America. Yeah, I have. You know, it's just kind of weird.
It must be quite sort of surreal seeing yourself approach your own table or booth. But yes. But no, yeah, as I said, you will be coming to the Comic Con on the 11th and 12th of May this year. So
I'll
thank
be
you for
here.
that. It's a wonderful town, as you know. You have been to Portsmouth before, and this
I have,
particular
yeah.
convention is starting to make a name for itself for being a wonderful celebration for passions and for fans and for families. So thank you for coming down, because I'm pretty sure you're going to have some interesting interactions with the public at this event, that's for sure.
Good show, yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm glad. I've got some more questions for you that I will be bringing along to the event. I won't leave you too much today, but I have been recently watching, trying to get into different programs and different shows and taking recommendations from friends. And one is a good friend in New York who told me to watch The New Look recently. Now, this
Oh,
is
right, yeah.
yeah, this is a show that I never thought I would sort of it would pop up on my radar, but it's one that I've been enjoying. about the world of Dior. And through synchronicity, as it were, you are a part of that show as well, sir.
I am indeed. I am indeed. I played Christian Dior's father, Maurice Dior, who's quite an interesting man with his own story, but it's only lightly touched in the series. Yeah, that came out of the blue. That was good. That was wonderful. It's a wonderful job. Very nerve-wracking, you know, but I worked with Ben Mendelsohn. I had a number of scenes with him, one of which I think was cut. He's great. He was just the most charming, courteous, generous bloke. Really lovely fella. And I felt a bit sorry for him. He was kind of stuck there for months and months and months and months and months. And he lives in Australia, and I presume he also lives in Los Angeles. So he, you know, it's not, you can't go home for the weekend, you know, whereas I could just fly back to London and be there. But that was a great job. It was huge, huge job, you know. It's all up there on the screen, all the money is spent on it.
Yeah, and again, another one of those shows where just everybody looks fantastic. Such wonderful costumes and set pieces and something you can... It's hard to sort of take your eyes off the acting when there's so much going on, but it's a beautifully put when there's such fantastic writing and such wonderful visuals. So it's a great show to get lost in.
Yeah, they spent a lot of money on it, and you can see it up there on the screen. You know, that's the way it's going. These streamers, you know, they've got a lot of money, so they can spend it. You know, it's all changing.
Well, I hope that you continue to work for many more years, sir. Yes, you were fantastic in these roles and in the horror and behind the sci-fi masks and behind those ill-fitting contact lenses. But you've got this wonderful personality and this fantastic voice that just screams to be heard. And I want to, looking forward to hearing more of it at Portsmouth Comic Con this year, sir. But my last question today, I know you're a busy man. I'm quite keen to know what you've learned from this career that you've had over the decades. What thing has been most important to you after each job is finished? What have you learned about yourself?
The lesson I've had to learn, which a lot of artists have to learn, is that some parts are for you and some aren't. I mean, actors always live on this edge of insecurity because you never know where the next job is coming from. And that, to some degree, can make you too keen and too overzealous to get the part. Well, I took a long break from acting. I mean, a really long break. After about 2005, I went on stage and I got stage fright, which was horrendous. Or something next door to it. I'd heard of other people getting it. I never thought I would get it. I mean, I've done so much stuff on stage, and you get nervous, but stage fright is something else. And I just thought, I can't do this. I'm just not going to do it anymore. So I took a few years off. And when I came back into it, I came back in with a completely different attitude, which was just, if something turns up, that's a bonus. If it doesn't, it doesn't matter. Now, when you're 30 years old or 35 years old, and you've got two young kids, and you're married, and you've got bills to pay, you can't function like that. Some actors can do that. They can bring that kind of attitude to it. And they're the ones who don't end up with the ulcers and the nervous diseases, you know? They're the ones who are philosophical and accept it. I was never like that. I was always one of those ones. And then I took that big break, and that changed everything. And it also enables you, and it enables me to, if I approach a role, just to play with, just be much more relaxed about it. And I think that helps you to be a better actor. Everything should come out of relaxation. But an actor's life is a very, very tense one. And I think the other lesson I've learned is that it doesn't matter how big an actor is, it doesn't matter how successful they are, they're all terrified. We're all nervous. I had a conversation with Ben Mendelsohn, who was a huge star. After we did our first scene, he said, did you sleep last night, mate? I said, no. And he said, no, I don't. I often don't. I said, you get nervous? He said, what? And I said, you know, Laurence Olivier said, you should get nervous. Because by being nervous, it shows you have respect for the job. And Ben said, "Wow, yeah, thanks for that. That's a good one." So even a guy like Ben Mendelsohn, he's got a lot on his shoulders. Obviously, he's going to be scared. Everybody's a bit worried. It's a very, very stressful, tense thing to be. Now it bothers me less. Relaxation. Let it go.
Good man. You've gone through it all, so you are no longer going to be running through underground subways. I like that. When you're suffering from an ailment, that's even more
Never
impressive. Now I've learned that fact that you were very unwell, you still managed to pull that scene off, and here we are today, sir. So thank you so much for your time today.
worry. Thank you.
It's been wonderful, and I'm really excited to meeting you at Portsmouth Comic Con on the 11th and 12th of May, sir. Thank you so
Great.
much. Have a wonderful
Thank
day, and
you.
we'll see you
You
soon.
too. Thanks a lot, Luke. All the
Bye-bye.
best.
Here we
Bye.
are. Hades from ASAP Imagination Comics. Thank you so much for joining me on the Portsmouth Comic Con podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on, dude.
I'm looking forward to this. I've been doing my research. I've seen the comics. I've seen what you do. I'm loving it. Without, comics, we wouldn't have Comic Cons. We wouldn't have so many different forms of entertainment in our lives. So you're doing important work. And to begin with, if you could begin by sharing your origin story with the listeners and watchers, Hades.
Yes. So I actually began the company during the dreaded time that was in 2020, when we had nowhere to go but our homes. And like many people, I'd kind of like lost my job. A lot of companies were kind of doing that. And you have that thing where you go, oh, I've got an awful lot of time on my hands. And I had two choices. It was either sit down and kind of famish that, kind of with the box sets and stuff like that, or do some work. And I'd always wanted to do comics. In 2019, I'd started putting one together, which we had submitted to a larger company, and we never heard back. So, with being stuck indoors, I thought I'll do it myself. So I
Just
did.
cut out the middleman, just do it all yourself. That's it.
Basically, I thought, why not? So we got to work, and a friend of mine from Twitter, who she's based in Canada, Laurie Cunningham, together we co-wrote a prose anthology, even though I know we talked about comics, but at the time we started with the prose anthology and a comic that was based in the same world, and that's how we began. And it was great.
Yeah, it is an international setup. I've seen the people that are working on board with this. You've got artists and writers and sort of organizers all around the place. You are sort of a league of creators, but I do love that the fact that you're not just creating a one-off story, as you said. You've created this world of comics and characters and stories, which is, just for me, that's mind-blowing. My mind is always like racing with a million thoughts a minute. But to sort
Same.
of sit down and create a whole new universe is a wonderful idea. So how did that come about, Hades?
I always knew that I'd got, again, like yourself, a million stories kind of floating around in my head. And as I got older, you kind of refine some of the characters you made in your youth, and you go, oh, that was awful. What was I thinking? And you kind of fine line them. And when we had started to write the book, we had come up with this idea that there would be this catastrophic event. And it was all based in London. And what we did was a double anthology. So it's called Points of Villainy, and then you flip the entire book over, and then you have Points of Virtue on the other side.
Wow, okay, that's fun.
So half the prose book was printed upside down. So at the end of excuse me, at the end of Points of Villainy, you were like, oh, what's next? Oh.
Flip it over. I could flick.
Which was great. And then what one of my favorite things that happened during that time was we'd spoken to a printer to get it done. And we were also doing it through Amazon. And I got the proof copies from my printers. Great. Got the proof copy from Amazon. Also great. Clicked approve with Amazon. 24 hours later, they rejected the book. And I can't, you know, you kind of go, but why?
Yeah.
And long story short, I had a back and forth with them messaging, and then I actually ended up on the phone with them, and they said, we can't print the book.
Ugh.
And I said, well, I said, yeah, you can. And like, we can't. I was like, I have it.
Have you seen it? I've got it.
Yeah. And I said, and it's got the word proof printed on it. So it's literal proof. And they said, change the format or we won't do the book. And I said, fair enough. So I left.
That's it.
And I took the book and we were like, right, we'll do that ourselves. And within, I think, 3 months of that, maybe less, maybe 2 months, we had then figured out how to do our own digital as well. So I stripped all the digital away from it was KDP that we were using at the time because Comixology was just merging into it. So I moved that over as well. And from that point, it's like, right, we'll do this ourselves. Okay.
You know. Look at that. Adapt and overcome, as they say.
Indeed, yeah.
With a hint of integrity as well. I love the fact that, okay, if you can't do it, I'm going to find somebody that can, or I'm going to do it myself. That, yeah. You know, that's what it comes down to, sort of independent publishing and people that want to create their own creations, as you have been doing, which is what I love about Comic-Cons. This is what we're here to sort of talk about today. The thing that I love about cons and ports of Comic-Con, which you will be attending this year, I could spend weeks in Artist Alley talking to artists, talking to writers, learning about new comics. Yes, I love to go and get the comics that are on my pull list, those ones that might be a little bit too expensive, but you think, hey, I'm worth it, I'm going to treat myself. But then you do go to the Artist Alley and you see these new stories, some stories that perhaps might be, you know, sort of a homage by other characters, but you do get new stories. And that is what I've been seeing from your stuff. I have been doing my research and I've been loving the artwork. I've been loving the stories. I'm looking forward to hearing you talk about this more at the con. But what is it about this world that you've created that just is clearly something very special to you?
I wanted to try and tell it through different variations. So obviously we did start with a prose book, which we then we took the 16 stories in the prose book. We took 12 of them, and then we've now redone them as comics. We actually have our first graphic novel, which will be coming out within the next couple of months as well. That will be our first trade based off the book. But I wanted to tell stories a bit differently. So, for example, we have a comic. We decided to make it a one-shot based off how difficult it was to make, called Hole. And the entire comic is drawn in first person, the entire issue. So you're seeing through her eyes through the whole thing. And it was great to just tell that story from her perspective, from the character's perspective. And when I wrote it, you know, I kind of thought, this is great. And then I gave it to the artist, and they kind of went, what are you doing to me? You know, because you have to get all these angles and perspectives, and you know. But again, it was also great because we got to do a reveal at the end of the book that she was also finding out, you know, in real time, kind of thing. It was great. And then to have a timeline, which we started to put together. Some of the stories happened organically. When Laurie and I were writing the book, there was a story that she wrote. Now, she is not originally from a comic background. She was going to go the I'm a traditional author route, and then I dragged her kicking and screaming into the nerdom.
Well done, sir.
no regrets. So she had written a story, and I just loved it. And you know, when you kind of go, this is a main character right here. So I said to her, look, this is you know, her own thing. You know, you need to do something with this character. She's great. And then she was like, what does that mean? And I was like, it means you need to learn how to write comics, which she did. And then things just spiraled in the best possible way. So she started to write a title called Sister Grimm based off the story of the book. I had written Messiah, Dead of Night, Hole. And then I went on to create another title called Person. We brought in another writer from Los Angeles called Nem or David Howard, and he started to write one, OPSEC. And what I loved is you mentioned homage, but we had all these bits of homage within there. OPSEC were almost like our BPRD, you know, that kind of sense. You know, Dead of Night was a kind of mixture of like Punisher and Batman, and, you know, kind of what would happen if a hero really fell.
Yeah.
You know, it was great to kind of play with the light and dark. You know, and it was funny because I talked to people and they said the first thing that you did was destroy a lot of your heroes, like literally from day one. And I was like, I know. Whoops. But it's kind of set the world up for what I wanted.
Yeah. And it sort of obviously transverses over sort of separate timelines as well, and sort of different lots of different genres going on there. And yeah. I said what I've seen, I'm really enjoying. It's clearly a very visual and well-written world where all these characters truly are coming to life, and it's easy to get lost in that world when you even just sort of get a glimmer of a character, of a new character that you start to like, and you think, oh, I wonder how they're going to act in this next situation. So that's something that I think is difficult to, certainly when you're dealing with new characters and new worlds, it's finding that spark of love for a character, and there's a few there that I've seen that have definitely got that spark. So you've clearly done your groundwork into the world of comics. I can tell this isn't your first rodeo, as it were, but how did comics come into your life, Hades?
So it was, I am a child of the 80s. I grew up with, you know, He-Man, Thundercats, Turtles, you know, all the good stuff.
The good stuff, that's it.
Exactly, it was so good. And then obviously in 88, 89, you know, on the cusp of like Batman coming out and so on and so forth. So I was eight, and my older brother, who's about 15 years older than me, basically just wanted me to leave him alone. And he kind of handed me a copy of a Batman comic. I can't remember which issue or anything like that. I just remember, you know. And he handed me this comic and was kind of like, shoo, go, you know, almost like throwing, you know, with a dog with a stick. And you kind of go, ooh. So he handed me this comic and just kind of like, go away. And I did. And I fell in love with that. And that was it. Done. Hooked for life. You know, and 30 some odd years later to now what I do for a living.
As origin stories go, that is it. You know, a comic was put into your hands by somebody else. Even if that person was trying to get rid of you for a few minutes, they helped you on your journey. That is still a pivotal moment in your arc, as it were. Yes.
Exactly,
I think
exactly.
everyone sort of has different ways of sort of how they do land into comics, whether it be just passing a comic shop and taking a step in, or for me, I think it was the fact that I just saw some graphic novels in a library, and I was like, okay, this is a different method of storytelling. That, you know, I think there was a point in my life where books weren't really cutting it for me, but then there's a book with some fantastic imagery, and I can remember at one point reading a version of The Hobbit that was a graphic novel, and I was like, I've heard of this book. Let's put the two together. And I think when I was sort of my early teens, The Hobbit was quite, anything Tolkien is quite intimidating. You know, the fact that he can spend a good few chapters describing a tree. So to combine that with a graphic novel, it was a lot easier. And I was like, okay, this is a different way for maybe as a kid. I mean, right now I've got a very overactive imagination, but reading, sitting down and having a story that I can read, but also see the visuals at the same time, it certainly does open your eyes to new media. And comics, as always, are still a huge part of our lives, which is fantastic. Yeah. And yes, as you said, you managed to turn that special moment into a career. So well done.
Thank you.
Is no easy task. Let's go with it. Never sort of an easy question, but what's the 5-year plan for you and the company?
So we are just about hitting, so this August will be year 4. And we celebrate, we do our own little online convention, which is because we're obviously dotted all over the place.
Yes.
So we do our own online convention for 2 days. It's quite interesting running from different platform to different platform and doing all of this stuff. We have game shows and stuff. It's a lot of fun. But because certain things happened that, again, happened organically, so when I originally started, my intention was to write, make comics and graphic novels and so on. And that was it. We'd been going about a year when I was approached by another creator, a guy from Colorado, who had said, "I really like what you're doing. I've got this stuff. Can we do something?" And because I'm a big advocate for maintain your rights, you know, to your IP, to your properties, and obviously I own everything in the out we now affectionately called our world. I said, "Well, I don't want to touch your stuff, and like, I don't want to buy it off you or anything." And he said, "No, I don't. I want to keep my rights." So, because I'm a glutton for punishment, at that stage, I created two completely new platforms at the same time, and I created the Any One World and ASAP Minis. So, with the Any One World, that is where we publish digitally and physically distribute for other creators all over the world. And that has grown astronomically, but organically. So I wasn't expecting it. I was happy to help my friend. We launched it with an anthology, which we did for charity. And then we put his graphic novel in. He introduced me to another person and then another. And for a period, we were just doing all the publishing from A to Z. And then I kind of thought, well, we've got this platform that's growing and we have the ability to do digital. Why don't we open it up to people and say, look, you can just have digital distribution if you want. So February of last year, I opened it up, and then the floodgates, they did open. Currently, as it stands at the moment, we are doing two releases per week for digital distribution, every Sunday and every Wednesday.
Yeah, let's just put some more work on your plate. Let's say you've got this passion for comics. You're making comics. You're making comic connections. You're creating stories. You're finding artists. Heck, let's just go ahead and make a publishing company at the same time. Let's just do it all. And you know, that's how you manage to. Clearly, that's the thing sometimes when you get to do the work that you love, sometimes in some horrible situations, that passion can turn into a burden. It's clear, speaking with you, that passion is paramount. It's the number one thing that keeps you going and wanting to continue. You're not like, oh, I've got enough on my plate right now. Let's just keep it at this level. You're like, no, just let's throw some more petrol on the fire. Let's see what happens next. I love that spirit. That's fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
So Comic-Cons, as we've been talking about, this is what we love, is that the fact that you can come along and you can talk to comic creators and artists that have been around for decades, and then you've got the fresh blood. You've got relatively new businesses, but people that it's their first con sometimes, speaking with people who are visiting a con for the first time. And that's what I love about Portsmouth Comic Con. It's still a baby. It's been going around for about 5 or 6 years now. So it's relatively new, but it's building a name for itself, just like your company is. It's getting out there. It's doing the groundwork. It's getting word of mouth, which is better than any review or, you know, any online quote. And that's what I love about this particular con and so many other cons, because of the fact that there are comics there. It's a simple thing that I've gone to so many comic cons and had to ask where I can buy comics. It's such a bizarre situation, but especially again with Portsmouth Comic Con, it's one of the big things there. And you're coming along, you're going to have a booth there. I'm sure you're going to be busy at Speaker's Corner and some of the panels as well. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking forward to coming to speak with you and seeing you're bringing along. So what can the visitors expect to see from you at Portsmouth Con this year on the 11th and 12th of May?
So we have got. I will be bringing everything from our timeline. So everything bar the graphic novel, because that will have come out just on the cusp, but everything else. So we've got 7 titles of our own. We also, we will tie in certain things with them. So for example, with one of our comics, you get some free music to listen to while you read it.
Oh wow, that's I like that. That's very immersive.
Yeah, well, this is what I wanted. So it's actually when we transferred the book over into comics and we decided which ones we wanted, we made each issue of the trilogy two-parters.
Okay.
And I've got a friend of mine, he's a comic creator. We've got him, a guy called Morgan Quaid. The man's amazing. He does voice acting work for us. We do his comics and books through our Any One World, and he's a composer. And I sent him these two stories. He's a creator out of Australia, and I sent him these two stories, and I said, "Do me a favor, can you read these and then come up with a piece of music based off how they make you feel?" And
Okay.
he said, Yeah. So he wrote a piece of music called Midnight Folly. And then when you open a comic on the inside cover, there's a QR code and you scan it and the music is free. You just take it from the site and then you can just read these stories while you kind of, you know, so you can get the free music from us. That will be there. You can have a listen to that. You know, we've got some goodies. We have a free magazine that we hand out as well that's got some bios in there. It's got a free little comic in there. It's got details of all our platforms. I will be bringing stuff from the Any One World, so you will see books, comics, graphic
Good.
novels from creators from the likes of the US, Tokyo, Australia. We've got novels as well as comics because we have some, we know some very kind of talented novelists. So it will be a fairly packed table.
It sounds it. I'm really intrigued by this music aspect. That's what I'm going to be want to be. I'm excited to see that because I mean anything where you can. Not only sometimes, yes, you can get lost in a comic. And don't get me wrong, I have got various playlists on Amazon, iTunes, and Spotify that are there for that particular reason, for the certain story that I'm currently reading. Right now, I'm making my way through the Terry Pratchett Discworld series. And the music that keeps on coming up now on my sort of recommended playlist is very surreal and sort of coming from all different sort of areas of the world. But the fact that you take out the work, you would give me the playlist, as it were, that would help me enjoy this story even more. That's fantastic. That's the sort of thing that's not going to just introduce new listeners, but also fascinate those comic book readers that have been around for a while and have
Yeah, I hope
almost
so.
seen it all in a way. So that's fun. That's very interesting. I'm looking forward to checking that out. I'm also loving the fact that you are, by the power of the internet, meeting all these overachievers around the world. I just like, could you write some music? Yeah, I can, but I could also sort of, voice some characters. I could write some more stories for you. I could help you change the story. That's what happens at these cons, is that you meet so many creative types. I love that.
Yeah, it
Fantastic.
is wonderful. And like I say, like I use Morgan as the example. But I asked him if he could voice our Any One World advert that we were putting online. And he was like, "Yeah, no problem. We put this video together," and he did this voice work. And and you go, "Good, I expected a good thing." And what I got was an amazing thing. And we show that video. We have a show called the Any One World Showcase, which is hosted by another Any One World, Laurie Calcaterra. And we play the advert halfway through the show because we invite people to, hey, if you've got a story, you join the Any One World. And Morgan is so crisp and clear and beautiful, and we because one of the things that we also offer through the Any One World, because we know that this whole industry for indies is kind of a minefield sometimes when you're trying to understand social media, when you're trying to make your way through this, when you're trying to understand budgets and so on and so forth. So as well as publishing through the Any One World, what we did as well is we also offer some paid services through the Any One World, and then we have an extension of that called Gig. So what we offer through, for example, through the Any One World, is if you have a manuscript for a comic, for example, and you're struggling and trying to think, I don't know where to begin with this, you can bring it to the Any One World because we work with a bunch of artists. And as well as that, we work with editors and we work with formatters and so on and so forth. And we can also keep those costs down a little bit,
Yes. And I mean, I do
appreciate that as well of what you're doing, because it is, as you put it perfectly, it's a minefield. When you hear so many horror stories of people bringing their original work, their creations, their babies, as it were,
exactly,
into the world of publishing, and sometimes those characters get ripped away from them. There's been some dreadful stories over the decades where creators and artists have lost their characters and lost, as it is, it is their babies. It is their creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And so you're putting in the work of educating the new people and the ones that have been around the block for a while, doing it the safe way and creating a community, which is what Comic-Cons are all about. This is what events are all about. And you're putting that at the heart of your company, which is, that's the hero in you, clearly. And I do like that. Yeah. So what's been some of your proudest moments over the years at cons or being a part of ASAP Imagination?
I would say the first time, obviously, when we first published, that was, a huge moment, because you have a lot of people who naysay. They don't mean to be in negative, but they naysay. And you also get that, but you're a grown man. You go, I know.
It's great, isn't it? It's great.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm also a huge child, but you kind of have that, and that's fine. And so when we first published, that was wonderful. When we launched the Any One World, seeing people come to it made me very, very proud. Mm. The first convention that we ever went to was Portsmouth.
Here we go. Well done.
Yeah, so the first convention we ever showed at as a company was Portsmouth, and I had a blast. We had a lot of fun there. We met some incredible people there, people who are still friends with me to this day, and also using Anyone World, oddly enough. But it was a great time. It was 2 years ago, I think, was the first convention that we went to. And yeah, so we did a live stream from there. We got to show our catalog was much smaller then, much smaller, but we still got to get our comics and books and so on and so forth out. So, and then when we also started to cross the pond, as it were, so the first convention we did in Canada, we've done a few in Canada now. And then a guy who's a great friend of mine, he's writing for us now, called George Medina, took us with, and we were on the table at New York Comic Con. So it was like, we were like three different countries. Amazing. Happy days.
Literally going global. But I love the fact that it all started at Portsmouth Comic Con. This con for me, I've mentioned it so many times before, the fact that I'm from Portsmouth, so there's literally zero commute time for me. It is 10 minutes down the road. And when I found out this event was happening all the way back, like in 2018, when it first started, I was like, okay, let's see what they can do. And I was like, let's see if it's the same as what London and Birmingham and cons around the world are doing. Yeah. And for their first ever con, there were some huge names from the world of comics. Yeah. There were comics there that you could buy for £1. There were comics there that you could spend quite a few more £100 on. There were toys and there were Funkos and there were people that have been to cons for decades and people who it was their first time witnessing what a Comic-Con could be like.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm this weekend is always one of my favorites of the year, because there's a lot for me to do to cram into those 2 days. So I have a very well-written schedule of where I need to be and who I need to see. And your table is definitely one that I'm going to have to find time in my schedule to come.
Thank you kindly.
I'm looking forward to hearing more about these characters and finding more out about this music. But in the meantime, for those that will be coming to the con, where can people find you and your group online, sir?
So anywhere you look, ASAP Imagination it's asapimagination.com is the website. Anyoneworld.com for obviously the Anyone World stuff. And then all on social media everywhere, it's just ASAP Imagination. I managed to get it there and get it all in one go.
Well done. You've got that link tree. You sorted out. It's all there for it. And that's it. Exactly. And there, clearly will be, there will be all the links to your socials and websites in this podcast article. Hades, thank you so much for your time today. Looking forward to speaking with you as soon as we made contact, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you do in the future and what you bring along to this Comic-Con on the 11th and 12th of May. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'll see you soon.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Cheers.